I think we are now prepared for a real session. Let me restate what we are trying to do. We are in search of the knowledge of existence. And our first experience of existence is that of all that is moving before us. The first experience of existence is the motion or movement that is taking place around us, around our individuality or around our egoism. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says that if you want to experience movement, then withdraw yourself from egoistic preoccupations. In fact, that is the very first sentence of the chapter. That when we withdraw ourselves from the egoistic preoccupation, then we realize a huge movement of the vast universe which cannot be described. So you might say we begin with one experience of our egoistic circle of movement. When you withdraw from it, you get an antithesis, vast movement, in which everything that we experienced before is only a petty swarm, less than even particle of dust. Our entire insignificance would be the experience when you enlarge yourself so fully. Now, Sri Aurobindo says that even when you go to that extreme of experiencing your utter insignificance, do not become overwhelmed by that either. There is a greater synthesis in which, while experiencing the overwhelming presence of the universal, you also recognize the significance of whatever you are. You should not be overwhelmed by the illusion of the hugeness. You should be free from the illusions of quantity and quality and realize the Samam Brahma in the bigness and in smallness. The same Brahman, the same reality is spread out. Now, once you have this balanced view of things, you have now a second step of the perception, second step of the argument. And the second step of the argument is that just as we are subordinate to the huge movement of the universal, even so movement itself is subordinate to something that is stable. So our first experience was our own existence, experience of existence of ourselves. Then the existence of the movement. In the third stage, we now realize that there is an existence which is superior to the entire movement, both of yourselves and of the whole universe. And that which is superior to this movement, its basic character is of stability. So you might say that real existence is the stable. In Sanskrit it is called sthanam, the stability. Now we are actually stuck at this point. Sri Aurobindo says that both reason Then higher experience show to us that there is a stability which is superior to the movement and which is the source of the movement. Our question is, how does the reason perceive this stable? And secondly, how does our experience give us the witness of this statement? This is our basic question. As in geometry, you have a process of proving in which you have first a statement of what is to be proved. And then there is an argument to prove. Similarly, we must know what is it that we are trying to prove. We are trying to prove that the movement is subordinate to a stability. This is what we want to prove. And we want to prove by two methods. By the methods of reasoning and by the method of experience. When by both the methods we can prove it, then we shall have complete satisfaction. We shall have a complete assurance that there is existence which is stable and which is the cause of all that is there in the world. And if you mean by God the stable, which is the cause of the movement, if this is our definition of God, then we shall have said that we have now proved the existence of God. All that you have been doing so far is only a preface or some kind of preliminary steps in the direction to prove this. So I shall restate some of the things which I said earlier and then move forward so that the entire process becomes very clear. You remember that we had said that there is in the history of thought a long effort to prove the existence of God. And I have given one formulation of the proof of the existence of God. I shall repeat it for the sake of reaffirmation. In all matters of reasoning, we need to repeat the same argument again and again and again. Because there are so many subtleties in the rational arguments that even though they are grasped at one time, after some time what you have grasped gets lost. It's a psychological difficulty of grasping any subtlety. That is why you should pardon if there are repetitions of this kind, because it is only a kind of a reaffirmation to our own process of reasoning, that what is to be a grasp is really grasped. So I told you the formulation of this argument, which is called the ontological argument, which was formulated by Anselm. A-N-A-C-L-M, Anselm. His argument was, God is that than whom nothing greater can be conceived. Mind you, he doesn't say that God exists. He simply says there is a conception of God. What is that conception? He is someone than whom nothing is greater, none is greater. That is all. This is the definition of God. So he says, I want to prove God who is conceived in this fashion. If you have any argument against this conception, then you can say that, well, I don't accept this definition of God. Then it's another matter. If you start by saying that God is one by definition, than whom nothing greater can be conceived, if you start with this statement, then either you first of all reject my definition and say, no, 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 this is not God. Then give another definition of God if you can. Do you have any conception of God which does not fit in with this description? And no, normally the answer is that this is quite alright, this is the definition. Because God is the greatest, the highest, the absolute. So this is all that is said in this definition. God is that than whom nothing greater can be conceived. He doesn't say God exists. This is only a definition, a conception. If I tell you that unicorn exists, an animal of a kind which is called unicorn exists, or that there is a flower which has been born from the sky exists, as a definition, a flower is a flower, whether it grows in the sky or not. It may not be really existing, but as a definition you can't reject it. A horse with wings exists. Supposing I say, what is the concept? That horse is an animal like any other horse. With this difference, it has got wings like the wings of the bird. See, in the concept there is no problem. Whether such a thing exists or not is a different question. Similarly, the first proposition of this argument is that it is only a definition of God. It does not say therefore God exists. It doesn't start with the proposition God exists and God is than whom nobody is greater. That is not the point. He simply says God is by conception than whom nothing greater can be conceived. That is all. Now comes the second step of the argument, which is very important. God who really exists is greater than God who only exists in conception. This is the masterstroke of the argument. God who really exists is greater than God who exists only in conception. And your definition was, God is that than whom nothing greater can be conceived. Therefore, God who is only in conception is not an answer to the definition. What is conceived is therefore God who really exists. So the conclusion is, therefore, God exists. In other words, to think of God and not to think of Him as existing is impossible. That is the whole purport of the argument. Among the whole area of the world, there is not a single thing about which you can give this argument. It is only about God that you can give this argument. A winged horse can be conceived but may not exist. Because in the definition of the horse, such a thing does not come into the picture at all, which comes in the definition of God. Truly speaking, this argument, although many people have criticized it in many ways, it is fundamentally a correct argument. From the rational point of view, it is a very powerful argument. And when you think deeply on this question, you will find that this argument is a really convincing argument. But the formulation of it can be of a different kind. As I told you, one of the sharpest arguments against this proof was one which was formulated by Kant. And I shall repeat the argument that he had advanced. He had said that this argument rests on the assumption that existence is a predicate. And then I had explained what is the meaning of a predicate. And it explained that anything that may be considered to be quantity, quality, relation, modality can be a part of a predicate. But in none of these, existence comes into the picture. Quantity, quality, relation, modality. None of them can be described as existence. They are all predicates. And the simple example that Kant had given was, $100 in existence are not more than $100 in conception. I should repeat, $100 in existence are not greater than $100 in conception. Of course, there is a difference between $100 in imagination and the $100 in actuality. You can go to the market and get things against 100 actual dollars. So there is a difference between $100 in conception and 100 actual dollars. But that actuality does not add to the dollars. It doesn't become $101. If existence was a predicate, then it would have added something to hundredness. If this statue is red, then redness is added to the statue. Predicate always adds something to the subject. If existence was a predicate, it would have made difference to hundredness. So, according to Kant, existence is not a predicate. And the whole argument assumes that existence is a predicate. Therefore, the whole argument is erroneous. That was his argument. Now, as against this argument, supposing we agree and say that, yes, it is true, existence is not a predicate. We may even agree that the formulation of Ansel in his argument seems to make a mistake of thinking that existence is a predicate. But then does it mean that existence is nothing? If it is not a predicate, does it mean that existence is nothing? So our formulation will now be on a different plane. It is the same argument, but formulated in different fashion. Existence is not a predicate, but existence is a subject. This is a new formulation. That existence is really speaking the subject. Predicates, quantity, quality, relation, modality, these are all predicates. Predicates can be conceived or may not be conceived. That is to say, all predicates are optional as far as conception is concerned. But there is one thing which can be conceived, and you cannot help but conceiving, and that is existence. You do any conception, the only thing that you can conceive is existence. You must have seen one sentence of Sri Aurobindo, where he says, Ashwin also last time that sentence. That existence without quantity, quality, relation, modality is not only something that can be conceived, but is the only thing that can be conceived. Other things, this object may be one or multiple or total, is optional. It may be, it may not be. It may be red or black or white. It may be white, it may not be white. You are not obliged to think that this object must be white necessarily. But whatever conception there may be of any kind, the first thing you have to conceive is that of existence. That is something which you cannot rub out from pure reason. Now to show this, I had started actually right from the beginning a proposition and asked you nothing exists and asked you to conceive nothing exists. And you have seen that this statement is inconceivable. Nothing exists. If you really think about it, you find that you are actually saying nothing. If I said nothing exists, it means that you are conceiving nothing. And conceiving nothing is impossible. All conception is conception about existence. Therefore, the one thing that you can conceive is existence. This is the new formulation of the ontological argument. Only one sentence, which may not even seem like an argument, because in argument there are steps. First step, second step, third step, like in the case of Anselm's argument, there was first a definition of God, and then second was the argument, and then the conclusion. But in this statement which I am proposing, there are no steps. It only says only this thing, existence without quantity, without quality, relation, modality, is not only what can be conceived, but is the only thing that can be conceived. Full stop. This is the only argument. Now, if you feel that this argument does not click in your mind, it means I would ask you to think again on this, because there is a subtlety in the argument, and it is only when you think again and again and again that you will see that this is a perception of the reason. You remember once I started by saying, what is reason? And in that process of reasoning, of showing what is reason, I told you the reason is nothing but a capacity to conceptualize. This is the definition I have given you. Reason is nothing but a capacity to conceptualize. Where there is no conceptualization, there is no reasoning. It may be only a sense experience or intuitive experience, but not conceptualization. Reasoning is the middle point between sense experience and intuitive experience. In between is the field of the reason. This is the field of conception. If you can touch and see a thing, you don't need to conceive. So reason is a middle zone of our consciousness. On the lower zone is a sense experience. The higher zone is a zone of intuitive experience. The intuitive experience is also called in the Indian philosophy, aparoksha anubhuti. Aparoksha anubhuti. Pratyaksha is that which you see directly by your eyes. Prati aksha, aksha means eyes, that which is before your eyes is pratyaksha. Paroksha is that which is not before your eyes, but which you can conceive. Therefore, conceptual knowledge is called paroksha jnana. Pratyaksha is that which is experienced by senses. That which is conceived is paroksha. That is the proper action of reason. When you can reasonably, by reason you can see something, you do not see with your eyes, but you can see yet by your reason. When you see only the smoke on the hill, and you can conceive that there is fire, you are perceiving it with the eyes, but perceiving through the with conception, conceptually. You are not seeing directly fire, but you are quite sure. Yatra yatra dhumaha tatra tatra vahani. Wherever there is smoke, there is fire. Therefore, although you are not seeing the fire, your reasoning tells you that there must be fire. There is no question of there may be or there may not be. When reason perceives, it perceives definitely, with certainty.
Because science has given
us the view of reasoning? Yes, that is to say, science has two levels, the pratyaksha and paroksha. But the element of pratyaksha is very predominant in science. In philosophy, the role of reason is more predominant.
Now the metaphysics is in this region.
Metaphysics is philosophy.
Philosophy plus the paroksha.
Yes, that is, no. In metaphysics, you know paroksha jnana. Pratyaksha is a starting point of metaphysics. But you arrive at paroksha jnana. But paroksha jnana, which is certain, there is a reason in us which can see directly. That is the meaning of proof. Proof is a rational proposition, a rational proposition which cannot be doubted. That is called a proof. So the speciality of geometry, for example, of metaphysics, lies in the fact that it takes you to the realm of pure reason and shows you what the reason can perceive. In other words, what reason can conceive. Because the perception of reason is only through conceptions. But what it perceives definitely. So when you are unable to perceive through conception, which you cannot doubt, it is called real paroksha jnana. It is jnana. It is not a doubt. It is not a state of doubt. It is jnana. You may not see the fire physically, but you are sure there must be fire. That is your rational proposition, rational perception. Your reason perceives the fire through conceptions. Does not see by with eyes, but with your conception, you are absolutely sure there must be fire. But there is a higher level where you go beyond conception and beyond the sense perception. And you can still perceive it is neither pratyaksha nor paroksha, but it is aparoksha. It is not paroksha. And therefore, it is called aparoksha anubhuti jnana. It is a higher intuitive experience. When the mind is silenced, the mind is a stage where there is a distinction between the knower and the known. This is a speciality of all mental knowledge. You are the subject, and all that is known is an object. Wherever mind operates, this distinction is paramount. there is always a distinction between me, the knower, and the object, the known. But if the mind is silenced, then something else happens. The subject and the object become identical. In that identity, you have the experience, because basically all experience is nothing but an experience of identity. Even sense experience is to some extent some kind of identity. All experience of all kinds have behind somewhere this identity. But when it is nothing but identity, in sense experience there is more than identity experience, also subjective experience. Therefore it is not a pure identity. When I see the statue, I don't become the statue myself. But there is a stage of consciousness where the mind is stills. Then there is a pure experience of identity. And in that state there is no doubt at all, because the object is yourself. Therefore it cannot be doubted. When I eat the sweet, I cannot doubt its sweetness, because it is a very much an experience by identity of some kind, if not entire identity. But it is a great deal of identity between the sweet that is being eaten and myself. Therefore, I cannot doubt it. Similarly, when you become the object itself, so it is said that reason conceives existence, intuition experiences that existence. But that experience is not of the kind that we have in the sense experience. It is an experience where subject and the object become one. In that experience you find that supreme existence beyond quantity, beyond quality, beyond relation, beyond modality. So these are the two steps of the argument. That first of all, the argument is only one line. You may not even call it an argument. You can only say that this is the perception of the reason through conception, which is indubitable, which you cannot doubt, which is only says existence without quantity and quality is not only that we can conceive it, but it is the only thing that we can conceive. This statement is the argument. Ontological argument basically is nothing but this. Now, I am quite sure that when you think of this statement again and again, you will not have that much conviction, because of the fact that you are not yet accustomed to think and conceive exactly what you need to conceive. It's like, I know, if you have a binocular, and if I ask you to look at a star, or if you have a telescope and if you look at the star, and if you don't know how to handle the telescope, you cannot see the star which is the target, because you don't know how to fix your telescope on the target. It is only when you have been able to put your telescope exactly on the target that you will be able to see it. Similarly, reason is like a telescope. And normally we don't know how to adjust the telescope. And therefore, when you are told this statement, you may not be able to perceive this, because you do not know how to handle the telescope. That is why I gave you one way of a negative way of putting this telescope. And I said, think of nothing. Think of nothing. That is to say, you have now taken out the telescope entirely of the targets. Existence of the targets, if you can fix on it, you will see it directly. You are not able to see now, Therefore, I am saying now you take out the telescope from the target completely. And I say, now think of nothing. Can you think of it? Now, when you see that you cannot think of it, then you will come to the conclusion the only thing you can conceive is existence. Nothing can't be conceived. Therefore, the only thing you can conceive is existence. This is the way in which you can set your telescope exactly on the target. Now, this is the first step of the argument, that there is existence without quantity, quality, is the one thing that you can conceive. Having established yourself on this statement, now there are two more statements to be established. Basically, you establish everything fundamentally. But when you still think about it, there are two more statements which are to be proved, which are corollaries of this. The one is that the existence is infinite. Existence is one. These are two statements. In other words, you have to prove that God is only one. There are two gods, or three gods, or five gods. When you want to prove the existence of God, you are proving also that God is one. In a sense, it's proved already, but I want to explicate it so that in the human, in our mind, concepts are very clear. So the first thing is to say that existence is infinite. Now let us make an effort to prove this statement, existence is infinite. Now the starting point is that all our experience, all our imagination, all our conception, I am saying three things, experience, imagination, conception. So any one of these methods, whether you go by the method of conception or by imagination or by experience, nothing shows you absolute beginning or the absolute end. You point out in your experience anywhere that you have arrived at the complete end. Whatever you say end is followed by something else. You may be seeing a film at the end of which you see the end, but after that you come out of the cinema hall. So something happens after that. See, that end was only a kind of a temporary interval, you might say. It's not the real end. Beginning is also preceded by something.
But the beginning is like there has to be a beginning of beginning. There has to be one beginning to begin with.
There must be, and yet, as far as your conceptions are concerned, you see that every beginning has an earlier beginning. It has an earlier beginning. It is a further beginning. It is true, I have argued myself that there must be an absolute beginning. But today, to start with, I am arguing that in your conception, in your imagination, in your experience, you never have an absolute beginning or an absolute end. I have come to that argument which you have presented. But at present, the first step of the argument is that you see everywhere a beginning which is an anterior beginning, an end which is an ulterior end. That means that nothing before you is really finite. A finite is by definition something which has a beginning and an end. This object is a finite object. It has a beginning, it has an end. But in the universal movement of which it is a part, which is the real reality, there is no end. In other words, there is no such thing as finite. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says, infinity imposes itself. Whatever exists, whatever definition you give of existence, you must say there is infinity. Now, having made this statement, there is a second statement, next statement. If you read Sri Aurobindo's Life Divine, this particular chapter which you are reading, he will say, he says that, but this is infinity with regard to time and space. If you read this particular chapter, having said infinity imposes itself, the next sentence is, but this is infinity with regard to space and time. If you have got the text with you, I would like you to see this particular statement. Page number 74. Read first of all the last sentence. Infinity imposes itself upon the appearances in the finite by its inextricable self-existence. Have you got that sentence? It is the last line of the first paragraph. Infinity imposes itself upon the appearances of the finite by its inextricable self-existence. Having said this, now the next sentence Sri Aurobindo says, but this is infinity with regard to time and space and eternal duration, interminable extension. Right? This is regarding the infinity of space and time. All that you are seeing in this world is nothing but space and time. In that space and time, you do not see any beginning or any end. This is the meaning of infinity here. But this is not the end of the matter. As you really ask this question, if there is really no beginning, then once I argued with you that whatever you see is existing before you. And this cannot exist without the previous thing existing. And that cannot exist without that previous thing existing. And if it does not end at all, then this cannot exist. If it does not end at all. Therefore, I would argue that there must be some end of it. That end, however, is not an end in space and time. Because in space and time there is nothing which ends. And yet there must be an end. There must be an absolute beginning. But that beginning cannot be caught in space and time. Therefore, the absolute beginning must be spaceless and timeless. And that's why Sri Aurobindo says, you see, read the second sentence. The pure reason goes farther. Have you got that sentence? The pure reason goes farther, and looking in its own colorless and austere light at time and space, points out that these two are categories of our consciousness, conditions under which we arrange our perception of phenomena. When you look at existence in itself, time and space disappear. So, the existence is infinite in two senses. Infinite in the sense of beginningless and endless, and infinity in the sense that that which is not finite, and to which all conceptions of which are applicable to finite don't apply. All finite objects are in space and time. Therefore, that which is not finite, which is really infinite, the concept of space and time don't apply. Therefore, we have one infinity of space and time, and you are obliged to perceive the pure reason goes further. And when you look into existence in itself, it is the ground of this whole thing, the real beginning, which must be. But real beginning not in space and time. That which is the real beginning is sometimes called only the ground. There must be a ground for all this to spread before you. So now you have got two infinities. The infinity of space and time, and the infinite which is spaceless and timeless. Therefore, existence is basically timeless and spaceless, which is the ground of the beginningless and endless space and time. This is the conclusion to which we arrive. Now, when we say that existence is the ground, the best way of understanding that ground is to understand the concept of essence. The simplest way of conceiving essence is the following. Supposing somebody tells you a long story, and after hearing the whole story you say, now tell me fundamentally what is the story. What is the crux of the story? Just tell me briefly, just tell me essentially what is the story. Now, if you will conceive of this essence, you will find that by nature it is not extension. The long story that you are told is extension. It has a lot of movement. It extends from point to point, goes on and on and on. When you think briefly, essentially, fundamentally, it has no extension. Sometimes it is even called, it has intention, not extension. But intention. Not intention with T-I-O-N, but S-I-O-N. Just as extension, E-X-T-E, S-I-O, extension. Similarly, in intention, it is intense and intention. I-N, T-E-N, S-I-O-N, intention. So it does not extend, it is intense. It is intensely present. When you briefly tell the story, the whole story is containing it. And you can extend it, you can tell the whole story, because it is intensely present. So if you dwell upon the idea of essence, you will really understand this timeless and spaceless existence, which is the ground of endless and beginningless time and space. That is why existence, which is pure, without quantity, quality, relation, all nama rupa, minus it out, what remains is essence. But when you say it is essence, it does not mean that quantity, name, quality is therefore completely excised. Because when you want to tell the story again in great detail, it is out of that essence that you can tell out the whole story. It's not lost. It's not excised. It is not destroyed. Such is the relationship between extension and intention. Such is the relationship between time and space on the one hand, and the timeless and spaceless. The ground, which is the essence, the true existence, is something in which time and space and all that we see is so much contained in it, it almost becomes other than what it is. And yet, when you expand it, it again expands as Naam and Rupa.
Otherwise, the time just stays within the review of the reasoning or only like?
Both. As I told you, three things. Imagination, reasoning and experience. All the three gives you the idea of infinity, of space and time. Similarly, timelessness, spacelessness is also reasoning, imagination and experiencing, all the three. Then only we can be certain that such a thing exists, otherwise pure reason can give you conviction, but only conceptual conviction. It is only in aparoksha anubhuti that you really get a complete satisfaction, yes, I have seen God face to face. Then only you are really certain, totally, integrally. And that is the speciality of Indian thought. The one distinction between the Western thought and Indian thought is that Indian thought has always maintained that what you can conceive by reason has also to be further proved in experience, even though that experience is to be of another kind, a paroksha anubhuti. But you have a complete certainty. So both by method of pure reason and by method of pure experience, you get confirmation of what you want to say.
Really, the refutation of Kant, as you said, about the epistle not being a
predicate.
So that the Indian thought, if it's not a predicate, it's the subject itself, which is the subject and the existence, it makes it so simple.
Yes, it is. It is absolutely. You are quite right. Actually, it's only one step. Instead of seeing this way,
it's
seeing
so evident.
Absolutely. That means your telescope is exactly on the target now. When the telescope is exactly on the target, you are bound to say existence without quantity and quality is not only something that you can conceive, but is the only thing you can conceive. Alright, now, Sri Aurobindo says that when pure reason sees directly, time and space disappear. Now, we have tried to see this proposition earlier, today also, but let me repeat before we go forward. Beginningless and endless infinity is something which you can't deny. Imagination, experience, conception. All the three tell you that you cannot conceive of absolute beginning, absolute end. In your experience, you never see anywhere. And yet, if it had no ground, this whole movement of beginningless and endless movement would not have come into existence. There must be a ground, if not anterior in space and time, there must be a ground, then only all this can move. As Sri Aurobindo says, if you don't have that existence, it is like a staircase which stands suspended in the middle, neither end nor beginning. Can there be a staircase which has no end and no beginning? So if that spaceless and timelessness does not exist, then you can't even explain this movement. Therefore, there must be another kind of ground. This is the speciality of this argument, that although it is true that there in the space and time, there is nothing but continuous beginning and continuous end, endless end and endless beginning, still there must be a very big basis and a ground for it. But that ground necessarily cannot be in space and time. If it is in space and time, it is finite. And it has a beginning and an end. Therefore, that particular ground must be above space and time. there is with me a picture, not a picture but a diagram. And don't read the whole diagram, but I'll only show you one particular thing. This is presented by Sri Aurobindo in a state of amusement. So, this is what Mother has said in the agenda, that Sri Aurobindo wrote this in a state of amusement, in which this diagram is a diagram of the totality of the reality, the world, everything. If you want to see a diametrically in a form of a diagram. Now, this is a long one, and I'm not going to just now remain on that point. But you come to the third page and see the last diagram, the last. You will see here, ground above, and the beginningless and the endless, the temporal manifestation, it has no beginning and no end. But it is rooted in that it is above. All that above exists, but not in this form. So the relationship between ground and manifestation is exactly of this kind. This is in space and time, and this is above space and time. And that is the real ground. So it is as it were.
These domes are.
Afterwards I shall come to later on. Therefore I was hesitant to give you this, because the moment you see this, you will ask questions about all this. But then you shall wait. I only wanted to show you this diagram only to give you how the timeless and the time are related. Vertical and horizontal, that's right. The ground is vertical reality, and the time and space is a horizontal reality. In the Bhagavad Gita, there is a description of Shastra tree, which has roots above and the branches downwards. So this is that. The root is above, and the branches are all these that you are seeing are the branches. Now in that paragraph, there are two, three sentences which are really very difficult, and I shall like to concentrate on that. We have so far only two statements. There is a timeless and spaceless reality to existence. And we have seen the reason since it must be there. So the rationally we are sure it must be the timeless and spaceless infinite as the ground of the beginningless and endless infinite. These two propositions we can see very clearly. Now I want to state a third statement, and if you go very slowly you will see it also very clearly without much difficulty. But let us see how far we can succeed. Our normal experience of space and time is that of successive extension. Supposing you imagine, for the sake of very elementary understanding of this statement, which is not difficult to understand, supposing there is a very small insect which can only see one or two points ahead of it. We can of course see quite a lot at one stroke, entire whatever we see, it. There is a kind of a scope. But if there is an insect which is crawling upon a small branch of a tree, now it moves little by little and it thinks that that which it has crossed is the past. And that which is now about to cross is the present, and that which is coming forward is the future. To our perception, the entire branch is in the present. There is no past or present or future. The entire branch is in the present. Why? Because your scope of perception is larger. Now, if therefore your scope of perception becomes larger, then what happens? All that we call past, present and future is only one moment in which all moments are contained. So what is the real nature of space and time? The successive movement, successive extension is only a result of our narrow consciousness. If you expand your consciousness, then you will get not a successive duration, but duration without succession. There is duration, but without succession. All containing one moment. All containing ever-present moment. All containing ever-new moment, whatever way you define. All containing. Even space, both time and space, they are both relatives. In the example that I gave you of an insect crawling upon the branch, space and time can be seen to be relative. The space that he crosses is past. The space that is to be crossed is the present. And the space that is going to come is the future. So extension of space is also the extension of time. So space and time are correlative. It is because of our normal notion that we make a lot of distinction to space and time. We think that space is like a box in which time is a running brook. But basically, both space and time are correlative. So when you think of time as all-containing, ever-new moment, similarly, you can think of space as all-containing extension without magnitude. It is extension, but without magnitude, which is a contradiction in terms. Because for us, all extension is with magnitude. But if you have now seen all-containing space, what kind of space is it? Just like all containing moments in which there is no duration at all. Or it's a duration which is only one moment. If there is extension, if there is magnitude, it is such a magnitude in which all points are included. There are therefore three points now. There is a timeless and spaceless infinite, which is a necessary ground for the beginningless and endless time and space. So the beginningless and endless space and time is the second step, which is all-containing duration, all-containing extension. And you will see that this is only dependent upon your consciousness. If your consciousness, we had said that the successive moment of duration in the case of the insect is dependent upon its consciousness. The wideness of our consciousness in which we see the whole branch as one present is also dependent upon our consciousness. The Rishi who sees the whole space-time in one regard is also a state of consciousness. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says that space and time, whether at successive duration or all at one moment, both are categories of consciousness. It is entirely up to us as to how we arrange things. What we call past, it depends upon the state of consciousness in which you are. What is future depends upon the state of consciousness in which you are. There can be another state in which the future is past. There can be a consciousness in which the future is past already. That is why it is said that to the rishi, an event is a smriti. He remembers the event. The event was already there, but he now remembers that event. There is only a smriti. It's a question of memory. Because you are situated differently. It is entirely a question of how you arrange your perception that makes a distinction between past, present and future. So, in the state of consciousness, depending upon state of consciousness, you have successive movement of duration and extension. Or you have all containing duration and extension. And there is a third, which is timeless and spaceless. Now, when you really have the full account of the universe, you are bound to make these three propositions. Existence is timeless and spaceless, from which beginningless and timeless, endless time and space are grounded, which are fundamentally all-containing moment or all-containing points on which you can inscribe according to your standpoint successive movement of duration and successive movement of space. This is the nature of the existence. The totality of existence, if you really want the real existence. Now I shall invite you to read, therefore, after having explained all this, these three paragraphs. On page number 74, all the three statements that I have made now can be seen at once here. We see at once, page number 74, we see at once that if such an existence is, it must be like the energy infinite. Neither reason, nor experience, nor intuition, nor imagination bears witness to us of the possibility of a final terminus. All end and beginning presuppose something beyond the end or beginning. An absolute end, an absolute beginning, he is not only a contradiction in terms, but a contradiction of the essence of things, a violence, a fiction. Infinity imposes itself upon the appearances of the finite by its inexplicable self-existence. But this is infinity with regard to time and space, an eternal duration, interminable extension. The pure reason goes farther, and looking in its own colorless and austere light at time and space, points out that these two are categories of our consciousness, conditions under which we arrange our perception of phenomenon. When you look at existence in itself, time and space disappear. If there is any extension, it is not spatial, but a psychological extension. If there is any duration, it is not a temporal, but a psychological duration. And it is then easy to see that this extension and duration are only symbols which represent to the mind something not translatable into intellectual terms, an eternity which seems to us the same all-containing ever-new moment, an infinity which seems to us the same all-containing all-pervading points without magnitudes. And this conflict of terms, so violent, yet accurately expressive of something we do perceive, shows that mind and speech have passed beyond their natural limits and are striving to express a reality in which their own conventions and necessary oppositions disappear into an ineffable identity. But is this a true record? May it not be that time and space so disappear merely because the existence we are regarding is a fiction of the intellect, a fantastic nihil created by speech, which we strive to erect into a conceptual reality? We regard again that existence in itself and we say no. There is something behind the phenomenon, not only infinite but indefinable. Of no phenomenon, of no totality of phenomena, can we say that absolutely it is. Even if you reduce all phenomena to one fundamental, universal, irreducible phenomenon of movement or energy, we get only an indefinable phenomenon. The very conception of movement carries with it the potentiality of repose and betrays itself as an activity of some existence. The very idea of energy in action carries with it the idea of energy abstaining from action. And an absolute energy not in action is simply and purely absolute existence. I think we should stop here. These are the things that I have so far told you. If you want to now describe existence, we have three statements to make. The existence that we see is successive movement of duration and extension. That is our ordinary experience. We find that this is our view depending upon our psychological condition, in which what is before and what is after depends entirely upon the standpoint that we take with regard to wherever we are. The given is present. It may be large, it may be small, depending upon our state of consciousness. So successive movement of duration and of extension is our ordinary experience of space and time. That seems to be existing before us because this is all that we know about. When we inquire further, we find that there is beginningless and endless movement of space and time. And there is a method by which we can see in which all this is nothing but all containing moments, all containing point without magnitude. And beyond that we perceive existence which is beyond space and time. These are three things that we make a statement about when we speak of existence. This is all that we see. What do we mean by existence? Existence is all the three at once. The timeless and spaceless, which manifests itself in beginningless and endless time and space, which in our highest consciousness can be perceived as all-containing, ever-new moment, all-containing point without magnitude, which, again, depending upon our state of consciousness, can be seen as successive movement of duration and successive movement of space. This is all that we see when we examine it properly. The rest of the chapter is now much easier. This was the main difficulty and very complex statements. The rest will be now much easier, and that we shall do next time. All right?